Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is Gail Hogan filling in for Ann. Last week, Columbus became one of four cities suing the Trump administration over its plans to erode the Affordable Care Act. The suit takes issue with the Take Care Clause in the U.S. Constitution that instructs the president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Joining us now by phone to talk about the news and the scope of health care in the U.S. is Washington Post healthcare reporter Colby Ikowitz. Colby, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Colby, this means a lot of legalese for the average person.
Sure.
Can you break it down a bit for us and explain why these cities are suing the White House?
Yeah, absolutely. So Obamacare obviously has been a major target for the Trump White House and Republicans since it became law in 2010. And since Trump has become president, he's systematically taken steps to kind of chip away at the law without actually fully getting rid of it. He's done things like cutting funding for advertising for the ACA when enrollment period begins in the fall. He's cut funding for Navigator programs, which is essentially the people who help people enroll in Obamacare health plans. He shortened the enrollment period last year, and he's promoted plans that have less benefits for consumers than the ones that are in the Affordable Care Act. And so with all of that in mind, these four cities, it's Columbus, Baltimore, Cincinnati, and Chicago, have joined together to sue the Trump White House, saying that they're not adhering to the letter of the law, because as we know, Obamacare is still the law.
Is there only one segment of the ACA that they're attacking with this lawsuit? You mentioned several different ways that you feel that the Trump administration is trying to delegitimize the Obamacare or ACA. Is there only one part of that that the lawsuit addresses?
No, it's actually asking the court to force the White House to, as I mentioned, restore the funding for the advertising and the Navigator programs, to extend the enrollment period for 2019. And to force the Trump White House to promote benefit plans that are compliant with the Affordable Care Act. And what that would mean is protecting people with pre-existing conditions, having plans that have essential benefits, which includes mental health care, maternity care, things that made quality health care affordable for Americans that in the past couldn't afford it.
Under then the Take Care Clause that is in question, all these things would fall under that.
That's what the lawsuit is says, and so obviously we'll see what a judge says when this eventually goes to court. But the lawyers basically say that it hasn't been faithfully implemented. The law has not been faithfully implemented by the Trump administration as Congress intended when they voted it into law, and so the Trump administration has a responsibility to faithfully adhere to that law.
Yeah, the question is, I guess, is there meat to this lawsuit, or is it really just a protest over the fact that the White House is watering down ACA?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one, again, I'm not sure that I know the answer to, although if I had to guess, if I had to put my politics hat on, I would say that it's more of a political move than a legal move. Just as there's a lawsuit going on in Texas right now that's trying to completely overthrow the Affordable Care Act on the basis that the individual mandate was thrown out. And so they say once the individual mandate was thrown out, the entire law is unconstitutional. That's obviously another issue, but both are you're looking at two sides here. That's the Republican argument. Now this is the Democratic argument. Both are just trying to show that they're doing their part on the right to get rid of the law, on the left to hold on to the laws with, you know, as tight of a grip as possible.
Ohio is one of four states in this suit, the cities in Ohio and other states. Do you expect any other cities or states, for that matter, to join this movement?
You know, it's hard to say. We do have residents from Charlottesville, Virginia, that are also part of this suit. For the residents in Charlottesville, Virginia, are an interesting case because they saw premiums rise higher than any other city in the country last year. Virginia is in a kind of weird place politically. They are expanding their Medicaid program next year. Obviously, Ohio has already done that. Virginia was dragging its feet on that, but we'll do it. So the thing with the Affordable Care Act, and something that I've written about, is that it actually is working for millions of Americans who receives subsidies. Those who most of the people that are buying insurance on the exchanges, as they're called, receive subsidies and are able to access affordable care. And so it wouldn't surprise me if other cities try to jump onto this bandwagon, blue cities, Democratic cities, jump on to show their residents that they're trying to protect their health care as well.
In your covering, then, of this story, you see that in spite of what the White House is trying to do to, I guess, undermine ACA, it is still working for many people.
It is. And so what I've written about is that it will always survive as long as the subsidies are in place, as long as the government is subsidizing people's health care, which it does for the majority of people, again, that buy insurance on the ACA marketplaces. Then the law will remain. However, there's this percentage of people that fall in this gap where they don't receive subsidies, and they're the people whose premiums rise. They tend to be people who are small business owners, entrepreneurs, some took early retirement, they're not quite eligible for Medicare. And those are the people that are really getting hurt by the rising premiums. And so but what the Democrats would say and the people in this lawsuit, that including Columbus, would say is the premiums wouldn't be so high if the Trump administration hadn't systematically taken steps to try and undermine the law and confuse the markets and scare insurers.
We're speaking with Colby Ikowitz, is a Washington Post healthcare reporter, and we're discussing the fact that Columbus became one of several cities that's suing the Trump administration over its plans to try to erode the Affordable Care Act. And one of those that you mentioned earlier, Colby, was something that is the newest out of the White House tactic, I guess you could say, short-term healthcare plans.
Yes.
What are they?
Yeah, they're pretty confusing, but basically they were intended to be stopgaps. So if you're in between insurance, you could buy these very cheap plans for up to 3 months. They wouldn't cover a lot, but at least you would have some coverage until you got your next job or, you know, if you were in between jobs. So that was kind of the purpose of them. What the Trump administration has done is they've allowed people to now to purchase short-term plans for up to a year and then extend that for up to 3 years. So truly, they're not short-term anymore. What that does is it allows people to buy cheaper insurance with less benefits. And what you're going to end up seeing, or what people who advocates of the Affordable Care Act are afraid of, is that you're going to see healthier, younger people buy those cheaper plans with less coverage, thus leaving all the sicker, older people on the Obamacare plans, which will once again rise premiums for that group of people that I mentioned before, that group of people who are small business owners or entrepreneurs who don't get subsidies from the government.
And because basically for ACA to work, it all has to involve all these groups of people to balance.
Exactly. And that was the point of the individual mandate, which the Republicans essentially got rid of in their tax bill this year. The individual mandate was to ensure that every American got insurance coverage so that there would be a balanced pool of healthy and sick people. But if you start allowing people to buy coverage that is not under the ACA marketplace, these cheap short-term plans, you're going to imbalance the market again, which was exactly what the ACA was trying to avoid.
So that goes back to health insurers and that they're going to be having to ask more from some of their other consumers. But how should the consumer be wary of the short-term plans? We've kind of said why it's important for this whole thing to keep in balance. But for the person who buys it, what's the buyer beware?
Yeah. So one thing that we're going to be looking for come to fall is the brokers that are selling these short-term plans, are they being transparent with consumers about what is covered? Or are they trying to sell them like any other health insurance plan? And the big fear is that people will buy these short-term plans thinking that they're getting health insurance and then get an illness, get in an accident, go to the doctor, go to the hospital, and find out that there's massive deductibles or that a lot of things just aren't covered and suddenly have these huge out-of-pocket costs. So the warning to consumers is you just want to make sure you're asking all the right questions. You want to make sure you're finding out what exactly are you covered for? Because if it looks too good to be true, if your premium for the month is really low, there's probably a good reason for that.
It goes back to that adage, doesn't it? Always.
Yes, exactly.
Back to the lawsuit for a minute. How would this lawsuit affect Medicaid patients, or wouldn't it?
You know, it's I don't think the Columbus lawsuit is what you're saying. It wouldn't directly affect Medicaid patients, because what you have to understand about Medicaid is that because Ohio expanded the Medicaid program, you know, you have this chunk of residents in Ohio that now receive insurance through Medicaid that didn't before. And so as long as Ohio maintains that expansion, those people are going to be fine. What's happening around the country is that some states are trying to implement work requirements to Medicaid, and that is creating a whole host of issues for people, particularly in those expansion states. So you had states that expanded Medicaid, but now they're trying to kind of roll that back a little bit by creating these work requirements, saying like, okay, well, you can have this Medicaid, but you have to work up to 80 hours, or you have to do community service or volunteer work. And advocates, again, of affordable health care say you're just going to lose people in both bureaucracy and the fact that people are going to get confused. They're not going to be able to meet the requirements. But I haven't heard, unless I'm wrong, that Ohio is considering that as of now.
What have you heard from the White House then regarding ACA moving forward? We've talked about some of the plans that they put in place about limiting the number of navigators to help people access and figure out what's their best plan. We've heard that the promotion of short-term health care plans is being offered and promoted. What's next?
I mean, if you can listen to President Trump on at any campaign rally or any speech that he gives, according to him, the Affordable Care Act is dead. And it's done and it's gutted and they've succeeded. But of course they haven't. As I said at the beginning of the call, the Affordable Care Act is alive and well for millions of Americans who receive subsidized care from the government. And so one thing that we're looking at is if the Republicans manage to keep the House and the Senate after the midterms in November, do they re-up the repeal effort, which is something that President Trump would certainly be pushing for? Do they try and actually get rid of the law again? It's not something they're campaigning on. Healthcare has suddenly become an issue that Democrats can campaign on successfully, and Republicans kind of have to be quiet about. But there is a sense that they are behind the scenes with the White House kind of planning, okay, if we stay in power, let's try once again to just kill this law once and for all. And then you would see those millions of Americans who receive subsidized care lose that care.
It will be interesting to see what the next steps will be on both sides.
Yes, absolutely. And you're going to see, I mean, watch Democrats all summer long, all fall, hammer healthcare as their main issue, and really particularly pre-existing conditions. They're going to go hard on the idea that the Trump administration isn't even willing to stand up for people with pre-existing conditions. So look for that in your campaign ads come August, September.
And here in Ohio, it started already, and it's election day today. So
that's right. I'm sure you've heard it from your candidates already.
Yes. Colby, thank you so much. Colby
Ipowitz. Thank you.
Yeah, she's a Washington Post healthcare reporter. We appreciate you being here with us.
Take care.
We're going to take a quick break. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Give us a call, please, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, in for Ann. Columbus is the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit to prevent the Trump administration from appealing the Affordable Care Act. Many Ohioans are Medicaid patients, and low-rate health care benefits people with low income. An appeal to what's become known as Obamacare would likely cause an increase in uninsured patients. Columbus City Attorney Zach Klein is heading up that lawsuit. He joins us in the studio. Zach, thank you for being here. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Gail.
Why did you decide it was necessary to sue the White House and go ahead with this lawsuit?
Well, there's a lot at stake as it relates to health care coverage for many people here in Central Ohio, as well as the negative effects actually some of the Trump administration's policies are having on the city's budget. So we actually had injury to our city budget, as well as, you know, standing up for quality, affordable health care for everyone in the city of Columbus and Central Ohio. And the reason why we have Baltimore, Chicago, and Cincinnati on board is that there's a lot at stake nationally as well. I think, Gail, you have to backdrop this to a little bit to understand why Columbus is leading the way. So as you know, I'm 8 months in as the Columbus City Attorney. And prior to that, I was the council president for 2 years and on council for the past 8 years. And for the past 2 years, Mayor Andy Ginther and I have gone around on the political side of things, talking about the importance of calling your senator, calling your congressman to stop the repeal and replace effort of Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. We won that political battle. The president could not negotiate and cut a deal with Congress. And so Obamacare stands. The reality is, on the legal side, the transition then went back to the White House, where, because they couldn't get anything passed through Congress, that the president now is doing everything in his power to undermine Obamacare, to make it so unpalatable and unworkable that it is driving up premium costs and it is driving up the number of uninsured. And just in the last year alone, you've seen 37% increase nationwide on the cost of premiums and 3 million more people uninsured. That has a negative impact on our city's budget. For example, when we pick someone up in a medic to take them to the hospital, we do everything we can to bill that person's insurance. And we typically recover 40 to 80% of the cost of the transport. We have made a policy decision in the city of Columbus that we do not necessarily go after you if you're uninsured for that medic run. So it goes without saying that the more uninsured there are, the less we can recover. That hurts our city budget. The same thing happens within the Department of Public Health as well. We provide an array of services to citizens who are on the margins, who may not have
insurance. Vaccines, all kinds of things.
Exactly.
Like that.
Women's sexual health, vaccines, reproductive health. We do everything we can, if insurance is available, to recover for those costs. But we're not going to turn someone away who may need health coverage or health services provided by the Department of Health. Again, the more uninsured there are, the more it costs the city to fund those programs without getting reimbursed.
Could local hospitals lose money, excuse me, again, just as you described, with uninsured people? Does it work the same way with hospitals?
Well, look, the more uninsured that there are, the more it's going to cost society generally because there's no one to recoup the money from. That's essentially how our insurance market works. So when you get provided a service, if you have insurance, then you're able to bill the insurance as the provider, whether that's a city or a not-for-profit, to recover that money. If you're uninsured, there's simply no one to recover the money from except the individual, him or herself. And that's when we hear stories about how medical bills have caused bankruptcy for many individuals. And that's certainly, in my opinion, not right for the United States.
Part of your claim states that the Trump administration violated the Take Care Clause. We spoke about this in the first part of our hour. Can you go over that again and explain why this is part of the lawsuit?
Yeah, sure. So there's two essential claims that we're making. The first is a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. Now, this is a nuanced law that is often used when individuals, groups, cities, states are challenging a president of any party because it's a law that has to do with rules about writing rules. And without getting and boring your readers or your listeners, it essentially means that in order for a group like the Department of Health and Human Services, or in this instance, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, in order for them to implement the Affordable Care Act, they have to have rules that go along with it. And there's rules about how they do that. If they do something hastily, if they don't put it out for enough time for comment, those can violate federal law. And so we're making claims. One of the claims that we're making in our complaint against the Trump administration is that Health and Human Services and Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services did not follow the correct process, and thus they violated the Administrative Procedures Act in the way they've written rules. It's a technical claim, but a very common legal claim that folks make, and we believe we have a factual basis to assert that claim. Going to the Take Care Clause, mm-hmm. This is something I think a lot of listeners will understand because NPR and various news outlets have been talking and criticizing the administration about their efforts to undermine Obamacare. And this is really where we say they're sabotaging Obamacare. This is a sabotage lawsuit. So Article 2 of the United States Constitution requires that the president take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So the president has a duty to make sure that, as the executive, to make sure that laws are faithfully executed because it's a duly enacted law by Congress. Simply not liking the law and wanting to do everything that you can to undermine the law is, in our opinion, an abuse of that of the take care clause.
Would you say that's the major component of the lawsuit?
Well, there's actually two components. There's the Administrative Procedures Act and there's the Take Care Clause. I do think the Take Care Clause is getting a lot of attention because it's something that folks can relate to about the importance of the executive's duty to make sure a duly enacted law of Congress is taken care of. It's executed. So here's some examples of what the president has done and that we allege is a violation of the Take Care Clause. Cutting Navigator funding. Cutting the open enrollment period in half. You mentioned last segment about promoting these short-term junk insurance plans that really only cover you if you're healthy, does not cover you if you get sick. He's actually – the president through the Justice Department has refused to continue to defend Obamacare in legal challenges across the country. So he's now switching sides and saying we're not even going to defend it. We think this law is unconstitutional. In addition, this is perhaps I think the most egregious, is that there's money that is being set aside that the purpose of the money is to promote the open enrollment period of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Instead, he's actually used the money to run commercials to tell people how bad Obamacare is. So he's redirected the money to undermine the Affordable Care Act. Those are just some examples. Now, partner that with words, with tweets, with speeches that the president has given. At one point, I think the president has been so brazen about his intent to sabotage the ACA that he said, since Congress can't get its act together on health care, the administration's goal is to dismantle the ACA by executive action alone until Obamacare is finished, prompting the Democrats to come to the White House to negotiate its repeal. And just last week on the Rush Limbaugh show, he said, you know, I've just about ended Obamacare. You know, so you're seeing this picture being painted of not only his own words, but actual actions that show an intent not to take care of the Affordable Care Act, not to make sure it's fully executed, but instead that it's completely undermined. That's a predetermined disposition. It shows intentionality that he wants nothing else but to end Obamacare himself, and he's going to do everything within his executive power to do so.
Is there precedent to this?
Precedent to the Take Care Clause?
To the lawsuit that you're – yes. Has anything like this ever been filed before that you can point to and say, look, this worked here?
So this is the first of its kind in a take care action as it relates to health care. The Supreme Court of the United States has shown a little bit of interest on the Take Care Clause in a recent case involving the Obama administration and actually the Obama administration's efforts for the Deferred Action for Parents program. It's like the companion piece of DACA that a lot of people are familiar with. That actually tied 4-4 in the United States Supreme Court because Justice Scalia had died. And the interest there was for them to learn more about the Take Care Clause. So I think that there's been a lot of legal interest on the bounds of the Take Care Clause and exactly what that means for precedent. What I believe is that the president does have a duty to faithfully execute the law. And if there's ever evidence of a violation of the Take Care Clause, it's President Donald Trump and Obamacare.
Is there enough teeth? Is there meat to this lawsuit, or is this just political?
Well, I think I'd be violating my duty to the bar if I was filing something that was simply political. I believe that we're on solid legal ground to make a claim that the president not only violated the Administrative Procedures Act, but also is failing his constitutional duty to faithfully execute a duly enacted law of Congress. And maybe it's just because I'm not a very good politician, Gail, but the simple fact of the timing of everything, politics never once came into play when I decided to be the lead plaintiff in the city being the lead plaintiff in this lawsuit. The reason for the timing of early August, frankly, was because we wanted to do our due diligence to make sure we were on solid legal ground to assert a claim of a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act and a violation of the Take Care Clause. So we spent months calling over the law, calling over the facts, calling over the president's actions in order for us to come up with this 130-page complaint that's very detailed. It's a voluminous complaint because there's so much evidence of this violation. We wanted wanted to make sure we were going to do it right because we didn't want politics to have anything to do with this because there's simply too much at stake as it relates to families in the city of Columbus who are struggling to get good quality health care for themselves and for their kids, as well as for the city's budget. You know, tightening budgets, we got to make sure that we're able to recoup money from insurance companies when we do transport patients, when we do provide services at the Department of Public Health. These are real effects that are in the city of Columbus and for families across our community.
We're speaking with Zach Klein. He's the Columbus City Attorney, and we're talking about the Affordable Care Act and a recent lawsuit that the city is part of that takes aim at some of those issues in the Affordable Care Act. And the phone number here is 614-292-8513. We'd love to hear from you. Four other cities have joined in this lawsuit.
There's four total. Okay. It's Columbus, Cincinnati, Baltimore, and
Chicago.
And you
expect more?
I do expect more. I certainly don't want to make any promise that there'll be more. But since the time that we have announced that we are engaging in this litigation, cities have been reaching out to us and to other plaintiffs in this lawsuit because the problem with what the president's doing in Washington is not only affecting the city of Columbus and its budget, it's affecting budgets across of cities across the country, and it's affecting families across the country. So that is a commonality. It's a thread of commonality that all cities share in our efforts to make sure that our families are protected and our budgets are protected.
What kind of timeliness do we see with this? We know that the legal system isn't always quick and easy.
No, it's not. Look, we just filed the complaint last week. If other sides come on board, we would have the opportunity to amend that complaint. And then, as you know, through the legal process, the Justice Department, speaking on behalf of the president and the departments, will have the time to answer. There'll be status conferences at the court. I can't put, you know, by this date it will be decided because there is a lot of uncertainty in the legal system, and it's certainly up to the court to decide the appropriate timeline in this litigation. But we stand ready to vigorously defend this lawsuit because we believe that the president's actions are violating his constitutional duty and his to take care of this law that was duly enacted by Congress. And simply because he was unable to negotiate a deal with Congress and he lost that political battle doesn't mean that he can then unilaterally and systematically destroy it because he doesn't like it. And I think, again, let's just give you an example of the president's mindset. In April of 2017, the Trump administration announced an open enrollment for 2018 would be cut in half. Later that same day, he went to Twitter to say Obamacare's in serious trouble. Well, he just hours earlier cut the enrollment period in half and then later is saying, hey, now look, everybody, Obamacare's in serious trouble. There's a cause and effect relationship between what the president is doing in Washington and its negative effect on families across this country. And I think this is important to bring up as well because I was listening to the previous segment that by sabotaging the Affordable Care Act, you're actually undermining and threatening everything that folks associate that's good with the Affordable Care Act. So if he's successfully able to undermine and sabotage the Affordable Care Act, that threatens Medicaid expansion. That threatens the bar on discrimination against pre-existing conditions. That threatens a marketplace that allows tax credits for families to get to buy affordable plans that actually cover you when you're sick. All that is at stake if you're undermining the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act.
This is what the Franklin County Republican Party is saying. Brad Sinnott, the chairman of the party, said, "You're more focused on health care than other pressing issues that concern the city." What's your take on that? And it goes back to, I guess, whether this lawsuit is viewed as political or really has any meat to it.
Yeah, so I read that quote and I kind of laughed out loud because I read that to say that Zach Klein cares about health care. Well, sure. Of course I care about health care. Of course I care about families getting good quality coverage. As I said earlier, Gail, if you don't have health, how do you get a job? How do you provide for your family? How do you get retrained? How do you go to school to get a new education? So, yes, I do care about health care. I want to make sure that good quality health care is available to all of our citizens in the city of Columbus. I was passionate about it because it was the right thing to do when I was council president. And now that I have the legal ability to do it as city attorney, you know, darn right, I'm going to stand up to make sure that we're going to defend the access to good quality health care.
But in the court of public opinion, I guess, you say the timing for you was because you did your due diligence. But others might say, well, it's right before midterm elections and this is just another political ploy.
Yeah, and I understand that criticism, but the reality is we spent the past 2 months, 3 months calling over all of the law and the facts, and like these things take time. And when we felt like we were comfortable enough to pull the trigger and file the lawsuit in a good faith manner that we believe that the president violated the Take Care Clause in the Administrative Procedures Act, we were ready to do so.
Are you surprised that even though there's been from the White House tactics to undermine Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, that in some cases it still seems to be working? So in spite of some attacks, it's still good for some folks. Where do you see it going then?
Well, I kind of hearken back to a Heritage Foundation study that said that if the president would have left health care alone and not tried to sabotage it and undermine it, premiums would not have risen 37%. So there is a cause and effect relationship between the president's action and the rise of premiums and the rise of the uninsured. I also think it's important to note that the city of Columbus funds Primary One, which is our local federally qualified health center, to the tune of about $4 to $5 million a year, depending on the year. Just over the past year, our FQHC, Primary One, has seen a rise of 3,000 more uninsured come through their doors. They're not going to turn anyone away. They're going to make sure that healthcare, the good quality healthcare that Primary One provides, is going to be offered to those individuals. But again, if you're uninsured,
we pay.
As a city, or Primary One pays. Just like same thing with the runs that we're doing with EMS. If you're uninsured, we pay. That comes back to the city. If you're uninsured at Department of Public Health and trying to get a vaccine or provided some sort of health coverage, we pay as taxpayers. So this is not a political stunt. Like, this is something that has a negative impact on the city of Columbus budget, not to mention the families in our community that desperately rely on stable insurance markets and certainty for them and their family to be able to have good quality health care. You know, at our press conference, for example, we had an individual, Josh, who was talking about the fact that he's a small business owner and that he has a pre-existing condition. He was born with a heart defect. So first of all, Obamacare now protects him because of pre-existing condition. Secondly, he has been getting insurance on the exchanges for he and his husband, and they're looking to start a family. They're a small business owner. They're an entrepreneur, and they've relied on the Affordable Care Act in order for them to have insurance on the exchange. And he has noticed drastic increases in those premiums. So that's money. That's less money that he has to invest in his business, less money for him to maybe hire someone because he's paying premiums that are unnecessarily being run up and increasing because of the president's actions.
Zach Klein, Columbus City Attorney, joining me this morning. Zach, thank you so much. This all relates to a lawsuit that was filed by the city regarding the Affordable Care Act, a lawsuit that is a preventative effort, hopefully, in trying to see where else this goes. Zach, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Gail.
We're going to take a quick break. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, in for Ann. And this hour, we're talking about the scope of health care in the U.S. after it was announced last week that Columbus was one of four cities suing the Trump administration over its plans to appeal the Affordable Care Act. Joining us now by phone is Executive Vice President at the conservative think tank, the Buckeye Institute, Ray Hederman. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show. Joining us now is President and Executive Director at the Center for Community Solutions, a nonprofit, not partisan think tank that focuses on health, social, and economic issues, John Corlett. John, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We have been talking about this all hour, and Democrats have long said that ACA needs fixes in Ohio. John, let me start with you. What fixes do you think would help?
Well, in terms of fixes, I think probably the biggest issue that needs addressing are the level of subsidies for people who are just above the income level. You know, I think subsidies are fairly good for people up to 200% of poverty, which is might be about $30,000 for a single individual. But I think once you get above that, I think the subsidies are probably not sufficient. And that's been made worse, I think, by some of the efforts, recent efforts that have sort of weakened that coverage availability, either by allowing people to buy these sort of short-term junk policies or trying to get people out of the coverage pool. And so it'll drive up the cost of coverage and make the need for increased subsidies even worse. So I think that's one area. I think the other area probably that the Affordable Care Act did not address enough is around the issue of cost. Cost was, I think, largely set aside. I think the focus was more on coverage. But I think if we want to maintain coverage, we've also got to think about cost as well.
Ray, I want to ask you about health care because, in general, it has stumped lawmakers for years. And in your opinion, what are policymakers missing when they try to put this together? Is there one key element that you think could be the answer we're looking for?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the key elements is going to be what I call supply-side healthcare reforms. That's increasing the supply of doctors, increasing the supply of nurses, making sure that we can make use of new technologies from telehealth medicine to, you know, online services that can really get out some of the cost drivers that John was talking about. Because so much of the focus has been on coverage that we need to look at the idea of how can we make sure that we have a competitive healthcare market. How can we make sure that we're not seeing consolidation among hospitals, among providers that unfortunately have the result of driving up costs and actually reducing the quality of care? So taking a look at making sure that we are using the innovations of healthcare technology, using innovations of nurses being able to practice at the top of their licenses and make it easier for doctors to continue to practice independent medicine as compared to regulation and consolidation.
John, your comment on that and about looking at this differently maybe.
No, I think Ray's right. I mean, I think the point that he raises about consolidation I think is an important one because I think, you know, the evidence shows that where insurance companies and large health systems have consolidated, that prices go up, that you know, when competition goes down, prices go up. I thought one of the interesting things that CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, recently did, I think just this week, was they put out a rule that requires hospitals to post their prices, their charges online for all their procedures. And now, I don't think that is the be all.
Because patients are consumers, bottom line.
They are. But also, I think a little transparency around what providers charge, I think, would be helpful. I also agree with Ray about letting people practice at the top of their license, you know, giving nurse practitioners more authority and other healthcare providers more authority. I mean, in some ways, we'll have to do that because mm-hmm. we're facing a really big shortage of physicians that gets older as the baby boom generation ages and moves out of practice.
Continuing sort of down that line, this issue of single payer system has popped up on national coverage. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of different proposals out there right now. But I mean, single payer at its core says, you know, we don't have private insurance companies. We have one provider. Usually it would be, as I understand it, sort of mandated or managed by the government that there'd be a single insurer, and that would be the U.S. government, that would provide for the payment for all healthcare services. Now, there are other proposals out there as well. You know, nationally, there's a proposal called, you know, Medicare for All, letting people access the Medicare program. There's the notion of a Medicare buy-in, letting people buy into Medicare. You know, some people have suggested that for people over the age of 55 who might not have coverage, but letting them buy into Medicare early. And then the third thing I've heard and seen is this notion of a Medicaid buy-in, letting states, if they would like to, let other people buy into the Medicaid program who might not otherwise meet the eligibility standards.
Wow, there are so many tangles in this thing. Ray, the underlying question that many people have is whether healthcare is a right or a privilege. And I think sometimes they look at other countries, too, and how they're doing it.
Yeah, no, I think, that's kind of the basic philosophy that we're seeing. And so the question is, how do you make sure people have access to good quality, affordable care? And so, you know, one of the answers has been kind of a single payer option where the government's mandating prices. And the downside to that is obviously the government's picking and choosing what services. Unfortunately, you know, the government can't pay for everything. And so the idea is that there are restrictions. That's how we've seen it play out the rest of the world. And as a consequence, you see less innovation, less drug development, and you see fewer alternatives in those countries. Conversely, if you take a look at kind of our system, which is a hybrid where the government pays for more than half through Medicare, Medicaid, and we see private coverage. And so the idea is, how can you make sure that people have choice and affordability of care, being able to have access to it? The ACA took us in a bigger direction of more government-controlled health care, and I'd like to see us, can we go back to an alternative vision where we have a little bit more consumer control with underlying fundamental protections of like guaranteed issue, pre-existing conditions tied to certain types of continuous coverage provision.
John, a lot of people are on private insurance. In the last two segments, it's been discussed that that is rising because of changes to the ACA. Do you see that continuing to rise for a certain segment of this population?
Well, I think the ACA actually helped increase private coverage because it made it available to more people through subsidies and through some of the insurance reforms.
But more expensive for some, right?
For some, prices have gone up. Better coverage, more comprehensive coverage. I mean, I think that's always the sort of struggle is you can get coverage that's cheaper. It just may not cover the things that you need and where it may be advantageous to people who are younger and healthier and don't have any sort of health conditions, you know, it may be more difficult for people who might be older, might have more pre-existing conditions or things like that. I think at this point in this state, I mean, Medicaid is a big part of the insurance picture. Almost a third of Ohioans are covered by the Medicaid program. Most children, for example, are covered by Medicaid, and a lot of older adults are covered by Medicaid. And so, you know, I think Ray's right. I mean, I think probably now in Ohio, probably about half of the population is covered by some sort of government program, whether Medicare or Medicaid. But private insurance is still important, and particularly for people who are employed. I mean, people who are employed have access to employer-sponsored health insurance. That's probably the biggest segment of people.
We joke, friends of ours in our stage of life, I'll call it our age of life, they work now for healthcare.
Oh, I think that's always been the case. I think a lot of people, when they're looking for employment, I mean, one of the first questions, people ask about is, what's the healthcare coverage? How much does it cost? What are the copays? I think, one of the things that's happened, though, in the private market over the last 10 years is more and more of that cost has been shifted onto the employee and off of the employer. So more high deductible health savings accounts, a lot more cost sharing, a lot more copays and things like that. You know, employers have been successful in sort of putting more of that burden on the employee to handle those costs. And I think that can get dangerous because it may mean that either people put off getting care that they might otherwise need and then turn into something much more expensive, or it can also lead to more medical debt and more medical bankruptcy. That's one of the things the Affordable Care Act kind of reduced, but we could see that begin to rise again if healthcare costs go up again.
Ray, I want to go back go ahead, please.
No, go ahead, Gail.
I wanted to go back to the short-term healthcare plan only because I'm thinking to myself, if it doesn't cover anything, are people not aware that it doesn't cover anything? Do they just don't care? Or how can people even be sucked in by this, I suppose?
Yeah. So, what the Affordable Care Act did is it created kind of a two different classes of people on the individual exchanges. And that's kind of the population these short-term plans are aimed at. One are the people that are heavily subsidized. And I think, John mentioned, that there are good subsidies for a lot of these people, that they're actually getting insurance almost for free now because they're able to buy, bronze plans, due to the higher subsidies. The second class of people, the people that we call kind of the off-the-subsidy market, and what happens is that they have seen insurance prices skyrocket, and they're not subsidized. This is the population that has been leaving and becoming more insured over the last couple of years, starting about basically in 2014, 2015, because the price of insurance has gone up. The short-term plan is aimed at that group of people, people that are more healthy, are not getting subsidized insurance, and are currently uninsured. And the idea is giving them a choice to be able to buy an insurance policy that basically meets their needs because they're not getting help from the government. And these are the group of people that have seen higher prices because of some of the regulations in the Affordable Care Act, the 3-to-1 age rating band ratio, for example. And, of course, any type of the insurance regulations, is going to drive up additional costs. And these are the people that basically said, if the only insurance I can afford isn't worth it, maybe because the deductible is so high, the premiums are so high, they're unsubsidized, so they're simply going uncovered right now. Short-term plans is a way to get them some coverage that they need and be able to help those people that are off the exchange market and are currently unsubsidized.
John, it is such a hard to understand issue. And when people are trying to get that insurance, it's very difficult. And one thing that the Trump administration did was take away what are called navigators, or people that would help guide folks into what would be the best policy for them and how the policies work, deductibles and things. Are people really being hurt by these folks not being around? Or on the other hand, folks have said, you know what, I think people all understand it by now. We didn't need them.
Yeah, I meet very few people who claim to understand how insurance works, healthcare insurance works. So maybe there are people like that, but I don't think the general public. I think it's confusing to all of us, even those of us who have insurance and have to try and figure out what it covers or doesn't cover and what our rates are. I mean, I think we have been hurt by the loss of those navigators. I mean, I think in Ohio, we're also hurt by the fact that we don't the state made a decision not to operate a state exchange, to have a locally state-based, you know, health exchange. We deferred to the federal government to let them run that. So I think, you know, if states that I think have done particularly well are those who have strong state-based exchanges, you know, with a lot of investment in consumer education and outreach and navigation assistance. I think all of us benefit from having somebody who's a little bit more expert in these things advise us, because I think it's confusing.
It's confusing. Ray, what kind of impact does this have on Americans when the insurance market keeps changing? First, we had the Obamacare and we had many insurance companies in it. Then they couldn't afford to be in it. They dropped out. Now there's short-term policies available. I mean, all this affects folks really in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's one of the reasons I think you see so much kind of unrest in the populace, politically speaking, because if you go back, you know, let's remember, you know, the quote, if you like your health care plan, you keep it. And what people have seen is they've been able to, they've been forced to kind of change doctors, change providers. We've seen a rise of narrow networks, right, where maybe, you know, you had the same insurance coverage, but your insurance coverage no longer pays your doctor or your provider down the street. So you've had to find some of those people. So it is complex for a lot of individual people that are kind of feel whipsawed by a lot of the changes, their insurance networks. And then in the provider networks. I mean, I think that the navigators, I didn't understand why we're paying money basically to insurance companies to help them sign up. I think that's something business should do for themselves. But, you know, the complexity of the healthcare system continues to remain a problem. And unfortunately, we have not seen that get better.
There's too much information sometimes, John. That's kind of the problem.
Well, I think the benefit of the navigators was, you know, they weren't being paid by an insurance company to sort of recommend their product. I mean, they took an independent view, a consumer-based view. And so I think it is helpful to have people who don't have a financial interest in a particular insurance policy or provider or whatever. But yeah, there is a lot of information out there. But I think, you know, people have a lot of questions and they need somebody that they can turn to, that they can trust to get help.
There are smaller and smaller avenues for folks to go for private insurance anymore. Where do we see this heading now? Is there going to be a return to some of these policy makers to try to entice some of these larger companies to come back into ACA, or is that over and done with? They're gone.
I don't – you know, the one thing I think I've noticed in the last year or so, in the last few months, is that you've actually heard financial reports from those insurance companies who are left in the exchange that they're actually doing pretty well. I mean, that they are starting to make a – you know, what I consider a fair or healthy profit. And so, you know, I think it may stabilize a bit. I think the unknown piece is what policymakers in Washington are going to do. I think if there's anyone disrupting the market, it's them. It's the president and Congress who keep trying to change the rules.
Well, we thank you both for being here. I'm sorry, Ray. We are out of time and we're going to have to go, but we thank you for being here. That's Ray Hederman. He's the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at the Buckeye Institute, and John Corlett, the President and Executive Director at the Center for Community Solutions. I know we could talk longer, but gentlemen, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening. I'm Gail Hogan, and this has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.